Although American Civil War and UK history is a hobby, there are small costs associated with running a podcast. So if you enjoy our content, please support the show. You can do this by pressing the support the show button or pressing on the link to buy me a coffee in the show notes. Thank you for your continued support. Daz, American Civil War and UK history. Cheers. Hello, everyone. I'm Daz, and welcome to American Civil War and UK History Podcast. This presentation is available as a video on our YouTube channel and as a podcast from wherever you get your podcast from. And remember, we're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. So today, joining me is historian and friend Tim Willing. Welcome, Tim.
Howdy.
We are going to discuss the Maryland campaign because we are in September and we are leading up to the 160th anniversary of the Battle of Antietam. So to start this off, we're going to talk to you about the build-up towards Antietam. So again, September 1862. So Tim, what set of circumstances is going to bring Robert E. Lee to decide to invade the North?
Well, it really has its roots months earlier. When Lee takes command of the Army of Northern Virginia, June 1862. And at that time, the Army of Northern Virginia is facing the Army of the Potomac under McClellan around Richmond. And he will then launch what's known as the 7 Days Campaign and basically push McClellan back to James River and his change of base to Harrison's Landing. When it becomes clear that McClellan isn't going to do anything, you know, he leaves the covering force there at Richmond and basically sends the rest of his army in pieces up to deal with another threat under John Pope and his Army of Virginia, which is at that time based in the Fredericksburg Culpeper regions. Jackson will fight elements of Pope's army, namely what becomes the 12th Army Corps at Cedar Mountain, will win a narrow victory there. And then Lee will join Jackson in vicinity of Culpeper with what becomes Longstreet's wing of the Army of Northern Virginia. He will then send Jackson on a flanking march to the west and then back through Thoroughfare Gap towards Manassas, where he will destroy supplies. Pope will fall back to Manassas and they'll engage there in the Battle of Second Manassas, where we just celebrated that 160th. Lee will have what I call his greatest victory, routing Pope's army, sending it back to the Washington defenses, where the Army of the Potomac's already being in the process of being withdrawn to. And reluctantly, Abraham Lincoln will basically ask McClellan to take command of the whole hodgepodge. He'll reorganize the Army of the Potomac at that time. So Lee's trying to figure out, okay, what to do. So so Northern Virginia, people talk about 1863, how fought out or used up Northern Virginia was. It was already that way by 1862. Keep in mind, just several months earlier, that's where the armies were, facing each other, you know, in the Manassas-Centerville area. So the area is drawn for supplies. All the, combat has been, you know, in Virginia. So Robert E. Lee's looking to get the war out of Virginia to give Virginia a respite. And also is the option or the opportunity for foreign recognition and, you know, trying to end the war immediately. So he'll set out to invade the North for that purpose. Also is the opportunity or potential of liberating Maryland as he sees it, which he's trying to depict as being hostily occupied by federal forces. At the time, however, Maryland's pretty split in sentiment. The western parts of the state are more pro-Union, whereas the southern and eastern parts are more pro Southern, more slaveholders out there, larger plantations, whereas the western part of the state was small farmers, shops, pretty much everything west from Frederick. But Lee, nevertheless, we'll see this is that is another opportunity. And then when in Maryland, it gives him strategic options. He could go into Pennsylvania. He could further erode northern morale. Yeah, and then if he continues having victories, you know, the British and French who are, you know, already starting to say, hey, you know, Jefferson Davis, you know, has made a country. He's, you know, he's made an army. What's more, he's made a country. They may come in and try to intervene. So, yeah, that basically was the rationale behind the invasion.
Okay, cool. Now, I want to jump back again. So, what is the state of the Army of the Potomac at the beginning of September? Obviously, you just said they had Peninsula Campaign. They've come back. And then you have the Pope's Army, which has just absolutely been routed at Bull Run. So, and also then going back to the Lincoln McClellan, putting him back in charge. So just give us a little insight on what the Army of Potomac's spirit's like at this point, you know, considering they've had this, and also having the fact that, you know, Lincoln is going to have to lean on McClellan again.
So some might call it a hot mess in a couple ways. One, you know, there's a, you know, Pope, who decisively lost Second Manassas or Bull Run, was trying to find a scapegoat, and he pinned that on one of McClellan's favorites, Fitz John Porter. And this would later result in Porter's court-martial, though he'd later, years later, be exonerated largely. But the Army of the Potomac, there are some morale issues. Kind of like other battles later in the war, they don't quite understand why they were so close to Richmond, yet they were retreating. Most people saw that they'd won the majority of the battles in the 7 days, really only losing Gaines' Mill. You know, Glendale was pretty much a draw, White Oak Swamp, they held their own. They won Mechanicsville, or Beaver Dam Creek to start it. So they knew they were the equals, and or believed themselves to be the equals in terms of as far as being soldiers or their soldierly qualities. Yet they lost the campaign. So there's some confusion there. As far as how they felt about McClellan, the soldiers were still very pro McClellan and would remain so. Into 1864, even, you know, at various opportunities, at various occasions, there would be rumors that McClellan would be coming back. So the Army always loved him. That being said, it's worth noting, you know, when it came time, Lincoln versus McClellan in 64, Lincoln still got 70% of the vote from the Army. But that isn't to say that they didn't like McClellan. They believed that he looked out for their best interests and wasn't going to needlessly sacrifice them. In terms of his commanders, you know, he was never very keen on many of them. He liked Porter, but he wasn't keen on Sumner, who had the Second Corps. He'd have a new commander of the 12th, which was new to the Army, as was the 9th and the First Corps. From Pope's Army, they joined the Army of the Potomac and got renumbered. So you had some newcomers who were treated as such. The 11th Corps, or what was, I think, Pope's 3rd Corps, became the 11th Corps, was left in the Washington defenses and didn't partake in much of the Maryland campaign. So you have different things going on. You have the morale hit from the campaign. You have the controversy between McClellan and Pope. Pope said McClellan didn't reinforce him fast enough. And then Pope and Porter. So you have a lot of dynamics. So while the Army of Northern Virginia was riding high, the Army of the Potomac was I think reeling is a pretty good word for it.
Thanks. Okay, guys. So on the 4th of September in 1862, the Army of Northern Virginia crossed into Maryland. So what is the people's reaction in Maryland to Lee's invasion? Because I think one of the reasons Lee is invading Maryland is because he thinks that he might get support and he might get people to rise up, because it's a border state, isn't it? So just tell us about that, please.
At best, it was lukewarm. Keep in mind, where Lee crosses over, it's basically west of a line that you could draw from D.C. If you draw a line D.C. north, you know, that area to the west is western Maryland. And that's the more pro-Union part. So Lee does not receive a lot of support from Maryland, namely, if for no other reason than where it is he chose to invade.
Okay. So what is Lee's plan when he gets into Maryland? Can you talk us through that, please?
Well, initially he heads up to vicinity of Frederick. That gives him options. He can continue up into Maryland, up towards Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, threaten the Pennsylvania capital, threaten a potential move to Baltimore and Washington, very similar to what he'd do a year later. But he gets up there and he, you know, is aware that the Army of the Potomac's pursuing. He's also pretty undermanned. McClellan won't know this and never will accept it. But McClellan vastly outnumbers him. And he's conducting this offensive, you know, with the Union force to his west there at Harper's Ferry. So he may intend on seeing what his options are, keeping his options open, which is really the best way to say it. But I'm probably getting ahead of myself. That plan kind of, he never really gets to execute really any of his plan. It's intended that he threaten Harrisburg and Pennsylvania cities. You know, and by threatening Harrisburg, he threatens Philadelphia and Baltimore. But he never really gets that far.
Okay. So along the way, a special order is found on the floor, wrapped in, by Corporal Barton W. Mitchell, inside that is Special Order 191. So tell us about Special Order 191.
So Special Order 191 and its repercussions go well beyond this campaign. It was basically Lee's plan, written the first week of September, when he was, you know, his headquarters were in vicinity of the Best Farm, which is now on the Monocacy National Battlefield. And he, you know, writes these orders basically detailing what the various divisions and elements of the Army in Northern Virginia is going to do, that Jackson's going to go take Harper's Ferry, that Longstreet's going to move in vicinity of Hagerstown, so on and so forth. And basically will tell, you know, McClellan that where Lee's army is. But the copy that's found was intended, they assessed, for D.H. Hill, and it just got misplaced. There's been controversy since who was responsible for it, whether it was Chilton, Lee's chief of staff, or whatnot. But regardless, the copy's lost and is found by a Union soldier, and it's relayed to McClellan, who now has basically the plans for the immediate future of the campaign literally in his hands.
Okay, so you just mentioned there Stonewall Jackson. So Stonewall Jackson is sent to Harper's Ferry. So on the 12th of September 1862, what is Jackson's intentions? And talk us through the Battle of Harper's Ferry, if you wouldn't mind.
So Jackson's intent is to remove that threat to Lee's rear and left. It's a Union garrison, I think roughly 12,000 men, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in that vicinity. Under the immediate command of a guy named Colonel Dixon Miles, though there was a general there on site, Brigadier General Julius White, who did not command during the siege. So Jackson's goal is to reduce that garrison by capture. So he'll actually move north at Harper's Ferry and then come back around. And if you can see there on the map, we'll invest it from basically three sides. Harper's Ferry really is an indefensible location. I know you've seen it, Darren. Mm-hmm. It really sits in a bowl. So you have there on the right, on the Maryland side, you have Maryland Heights, really tall elevated terrain that overlooks straight down into Harper's Ferry. Conversely, on the Virginia side, you have Loudoun Heights. There, Jackson will have troops on both of those. McLaws there on Maryland Heights. And then he will come from Charlestown, vicinity of Charlestown. He'll move in and he'll set up position on what's known as Schoolhouse Ridge, which is a great artillery platform. And basically from there, you know, they'll be opposing a Union line on a lower ridge further to the east. Limited infantry firing, but Jackson's got great artillery positions from Schoolhouse Ridge, Loudoun Heights, Maryland Heights, and is basically able to bombard the Union forces at will. Eventually, a Union cavalry column will break out, but ultimately, Dixon Miles, who's wounded pretty much right there, you know, at the end of the siege, will elect to surrender. And at that time, it will be the largest surrender of U.S. forces in American history. It will not be exceeded until World War II and the surrender of Corregidor Bataan at the beginning of World War II to Japanese.
So would you say this is one of Jackson's easiest victories?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I mean, it really shows, as Bud Robertson, the late Bud Robertson noted, it really showed Jackson, you know, the artillerist at his best.
Mm-hmm. And again, Harper's Ferry is an arsenal. So did they utilize the capture of that?
Really, much of the arsenal had been relocated at the beginning of the war by both sides. When the war started, the Confederates moved much of the arsenal down to Tredegar and other Confederate arsenals. So it really was just a strategic point from which to launch operations moving on. Yes, it could be used as a depot, but you can see there it sits at the confluence of the Shenandoah and Potomac Rivers. So it was a strategic location more than it was of further logistical value.
Mm-hmm. And going back to what you're saying about the amount of Union soldiers captured, it was 12,419-ish. Mm-hmm. That's huge. I mean, that's a massive amount of men to lose, isn't it?
Keep in mind, it isn't the biggest surrender up to that point. The largest surrender in the war was the Confederate surrender of Fort Donelson nearly 7 months earlier. But this one being... you know, taking place so close to Washington would have a morale impact in the North. Units that were involved when they were paroled would, you know, you had like the 111th in New York, which would be referred to as the Harper's Ferry Cowards. Mm-hmm. Units that were involved would seek throughout the remainder of the war for opportunities to redeem themselves.
Okay. So what happens to the colonel, Dixon Miles, then after this? Because it must have been very embarrassing for him, you know?
Well, he was mortally wounded right at the end of the siege.
Okay.
So he may have been even after he, you know, decided to surrender. But right there at the tail end of the siege, he was mortally wounded by an artillery shell. So he didn't survive.
Cool. Okay, so that's the Battle of Harper's Ferry. And then we move on to the Battle of South Mountain, which is a series of battles through a series of gaps. So talk us through the Battle of South Mountain, if you wouldn't mind, please.
Okay, so you start South Mountain with the finding of, You know, Lee Camp's at the best farm there at Monocacy. He heads through South Mountain towards Boonesboro, which is to the west. So basically you can draw a line. You have Frederick, which is where Monocacy is basically. Then you have Boonesboro on the other side of South Mountain, and then you have Sharpsburg past Boonesboro. So Lee's in Boonesboro, basically. McClellan has special orders 191, but he moves, depends who you talk to. So McClellan defenders say he moves as fast as could be expected under a time. Others say McClellan dragged his feet. If you read Sears, Stephen W. Sears's work on McClellan and on Antietam, he drags his feet. Others are a little bit more understanding. But regardless, McClellan gets the order and says, you know, I have this thing with which if I can't whip Bobby Lee, I'll go home. So he needs to move against Lee. Well, he has this big obstacle, and if you're standing there in Frederick, you can see South Mountain looming up in front of you. It's formidable. It's really only passable through a series of these gaps. From the south, you have Crampton's Gap, then Fox's Gap, and then Turner's Gap are the closest ones for him to use. So he'll basically send elements of his army to secure each of these three gaps. So to the south, you'll have Slocum. This is a division of Franklin's Sixth Corps. Will fight McClaw's division of Longstreet's wing at Crampton's Gap. They'll succeed. It's really not the best known or really even the best studied. Really wasn't the most intense of the fights there on South Mountain, but they'll secure that, and from which he'll threaten to relieve Harper's Ferry because the siege is ongoing at that point. But we'll never really get that far in that attempt. And then you have Fox's Gap, and that will be addressed by the Ninth Corps, which is not under Burnside's command. It's under command of a guy named Jesse Reno, who will send his divisions to secure that gap. And so he'll be fighting, it's Jackson's Corps. Even though Jackson's gone, you know, it was an ad hoc detachment. He's fighting G.T. Anderson, Law, and Wofford's brigades, their Fox's Gap. So much of fighting will initially consist of Jacob Cox's unit. I think in there you have the 17th Michigan, which launches an assault across a pre-open cornfield. They'll suffer pretty heavy casualties. They have a monument there now. Some North Carolinians make a stand on the, what would be the western side of the battlefield. So they're facing south. And they'll suffer heavily later. You know, there'll be stories about local farmers throwing Confederate corpses down a well, things like that, which they claim today is haunted. But there's a rather impressive monument to North Carolinians there on the South Mountain battlefield, there at Fox's Gap. But in the midst of this fighting, Jesse Reno, the Ninth Corps commander, who was viewed as an up-and-coming general and perhaps one of the better corps commanders at the time, he'll be mortally wounded in this battle. So that is a hit. But kind of like Crampton's Gap, the Confederates will eventually be forced to withdraw, leaving the gap open for McClellan. And then finally you have Turner's Gap, which is further to the north, and that's where the National Road, it was as it was called at the time, passed through South Mountain. And that will be a responsibility of Hooker's First Corps. Hooker had been in the Third Corps as a division commander during the Peninsula Campaign after 2nd Manassas and the I think I probably misspoke earlier. I think it was the 1st Corps became the 11th, and the 3rd Corps became the 1st. 3rd Corps of Pope's Army became the 1st of the Army of the Potomac. Hooker was given command of that, so his responsibility is to clear Turner's Gap, which, to make the confusing topography even more confusing, there's basically two parts of Turner's Gap. You have Turner's Gap West and Turner's Gap East. So on the western part, that will be under Hatch's division of the 1st Corps, which includes a unit of Midwesterners, Wisconsin and Indiana men, that had really had their first true baptism of fire a couple weeks earlier at Bronner Farm on 2nd Manassas. And they, you know, had engaged in a stand-up fight with the Stonewall Brigade and, you know, were recognized there. Here they will fight at Turner's Gap and will make progress pushing the Confederates back there. They will be fighting Colquitt's Brigade of Longstreet's Corps. There on the National Road. And allegedly it's McClellan himself who's, you know, will refer to these men and say that they stood like iron. And from then on, they became known as the Iron Brigade. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, the other Union divisions under Meade with the Pennsylvania Reserves and Ricketts will engage primarily in what's known as Turner's Gap East. It's really steep, rocky terrain if you go there, boulders everywhere. It really only levels out near the crest. So it's really horrendous terrain to attack over. A lot of elevation changes. But eventually the Confederates, though they feed reinforcements up, are eventually pushed back. Lee is not trying to hold the gaps. He's trying to fight a delaying action. And in large degree, he succeeds. The Union Army has to attack up this mountain. It's exhausting. So while they fail to hold the gap, they really don't make an attempt to do so and execute an orderly withdrawal back to Boonesboro and ultimately back to Sharpsburg.
Okay, so the majority of the Confederate Army then are at Boonesboro, are they, at the time? Is that right?
Well, you still have Longstreet with some elements up near Hagerstown, but they're starting to move towards a consolidation point, which after South Mountain becomes Sharpsburg.
Okay, and do you know why that is Sharpsburg, or is it, you know?
It's very much like another town that we know in southern Pennsylvania. It's where all the roads lead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, that's pretty much where we get to. And the roads all lead to Sharpsburg. And as everyone will know, on the 17th of September will be the bloodiest day in American history. And that's going to continue when we do an Antietam podcast, which will be on soon. So all that's left to say is appreciate your time, Tim. Thank you for coming on. I know this was a quick podcast compared to some of the others, but it was just a little explanation in the build up to the bloodiest day in American history, which is Antietam. So
Well, keep in mind one thing. I mean, all this fighting took place on the 14th of September there at South Mountain. Mm-hmm. So the gaps were secure. The Army of the Potomac outnumbers Lee's army, though McClellan will not believe so. He thinks he's outnumbered. But the Battle of Antietam doesn't take place for another 3 days. So that affords Lee a lot of time. You know, mm-hmm. Yes, the Union Army will need to rest. But for those 3 days, Lee's army is vulnerable. So that's worth noting that despite the Union victory, and it was a victory at South Mountain, that to a large degree will be wasted over the subsequent 3 days.
Okay, cool. Well, like I said, ladies and gentlemen, please join us for a Antietam podcast in the near future. Thank you for listening. Cheers.